NBC Radio continues to cancel all of its regularly scheduled programming. In the next 4 hours, you will hear a memorial tribute to our late president and an evaluation of the impact on history of his life and death. President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the highest price.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
The words of John F. Kennedy, delivered on a cold January day a short 2 years, 10 months ago. Since that inauguration, the words of President Kennedy, the ready smiles, the quick handshakes, the unbounded energies, have generated a love and affection that few men can ever know. It is from that same love and affection that a nation and a world now is consumed with grief and mourning. Even in a speech never delivered, the late president underscored the emotional feeling he had for his fellow Americans and they for him.
We in this country, in this generation, are by destiny rather than choice the watchmen on the walls of world freedom. We ask, therefore, that we may be worthy of our power and responsibility, that we may exercise our strength with wisdom and restraint, and that we may achieve in our time and for all time the ancient vision of peace on earth, goodwill toward men. That must always be our goal, and the righteousness of our cause must always underlie our strength. For as was written long ago, except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain.
Those words from a Kennedy speech read by Alexander Scorby, but never delivered by the intended speaker. Mr. Kennedy was cut down by an assassin's bullet just a short time before his scheduled address in Dallas. The death of the president left the nation in shock. Factory workers in Chicago leaving their jobs in disbelief. Housewives in Los Angeles running from supermarkets in near shock. Symphony audiences in Boston refusing to accept the tragedy. Conductor Eric Leinsdorf, backstage after conducting a selection, was told of the assassination. It was a grieving Leinsdorf, barely maintaining his composure, who announced the news to his audience.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a press report over the wires. We hope that it is unconfirmed, but we have to doubt it, that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination. We will play the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy, by the act of assassination, has been taken out of the list of presidents and put into the list of legends. Well, when a man attains that status, he is out of the ordinary lists of historical figures and becomes a symbol.
73-year-old Gerald Johnson, noted author and historian.
I think that the name of Kennedy, from now on, is going to mean not a political Later, it's got to be associated with qualities that time and detraction have no influence on. Courage, loyalty, devotion, youth, gaiety, beauty, the high heart and the strong hand. And to have a symbol of that kind is more important to a nation than to have a political leader. Political leaders are a dime a dozen, but symbols are the rarest thing in the world. Hatred has recoiled on itself in this case, and in destroying a man, it has given the nation a symbol, and even in this moment of grief, I am not prepared to deny that the nation is the gainer.
This is Russ Ward in New York, and for the next 4 hours, a look back at the life and times of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, a story told by the man himself and by those who knew him best. From time to time during the evening, we'll interrupt briefly to bring you any late developments from Dallas or elsewhere as this story of tragedy continues to unfold. John F. Kennedy was not just the 35th president. The simple statistics by which he will be remembered in history give way to the more human aspects of the man. His casual informality with reporters, for example. His readiness to enjoy a joke even about himself. The attractiveness of his young family. The feeling that he was everybody's president. It's not easy to explore a man's courage or his intellect, but certainly with President Kennedy, his public utterances reflected the kind of dedication with which he administered the affairs of state. One public speech, the one he did not live to deliver, tells about that dedication in a few brief words. Here again, Alexander Scorby.
Finally, it should be clear by now that a nation can be no stronger abroad than she is at home. Only an America which practices what it preaches about equal rights and social justice will be respected by those whose choice affects our future. Only an America which has fully educated its citizens is fully capable of tackling the complex problems and perceiving the hidden dangers of the world in which we live.
Where does a man like this come from? How, out of 180 million Americans, can a single individual be lifted to such heights of esteem? Who opened the doors or pointed the way? At what point does destiny actually begin? Among those who watched a youthful enthusiasm being molded into a sense of dedication was Professor Oscar Hanlon of Harvard University.
The strength of Kennedy, and I think he was strong, lay in the fact that he united two important features, a deep awareness of the popular needs of the country and of his own roots in the society, and a genuine appreciation for intelligence, which he wished to bring to the services of the people. In a way, it's almost characteristic that he should have come up through the, on the one hand, through the rough, hard school of Boston politics, and on the other hand, through Harvard and kind of education, the kind of culture he acquired there. In that sense, he was establishing a fusion between two different strands that were representative of the best in our times.
The man who was our 35th president was born on May 29th, 1917, in Brookline, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. His first years there were spent at 83 Beale Street, a comfortable white frame house in a pleasant upper middle class neighborhood. The Kennedy youngsters found their main stimulation and interest in their own family circle. Their friend, Justice William O. Douglas of the Supreme Court, has said, "After all, it was an exciting home, a good place to be, full of fun and games and plenty of fascinating talk about the world affairs and world leaders. It was hard for them to find anything as attractive outside. This is why they are so attached to each other and so secure." This generation of Kennedys, as well as the two generations before them, has lived according to the tradition established by Patrick Joseph Kennedy, the late president's grandfather. As Pat saw it, there was room for only one at the top. A contender who placed second was a loser. He served in both branches of the state legislature, but was far more effective as a strategist behind the scenes. At the turn of the century, he was chairman of a group self-constituted to pick all the Democratic candidates for city, county, and state offices. One member of that board was John F. Fitzgerald, Honey Fitz. Honey Fitz, who became mayor of Boston, had a curious political career. The voters loved him, the politicians did not. Neither did he get along well with Pat Kennedy, but the two men needed each other. It is said that Pat then would have shuddered at the thought that he and Honey Fitz would one day have grandchildren in common. Joseph P. Kennedy and Rose Fitzgerald were married on October 7th, 1914. They had 9 children. When John Bettinger, son-in-law of President Franklin Roosevelt, first met the family, he surveyed the 9 children, looked at their slender, youthful, dark-haired mother, and said, "At last I can believe in the stork." Only 1 year of John Kennedy's education was spent in a Catholic institution. That was Canterbury, the preparatory school at New Milford, Massachusetts, where he went for a year at the age of 13. The next fall, he shifted to Choate at Wallingford, Connecticut, a rather exclusive boys' school. At Choate, one of his friends was T. Robert McCubbin.
Jack Kennedy, late president, had an exceedingly good sense of humor. It was often referred to, his teachers often kidded him about having a good Gaelic sense of humor, which I think he did. He had a real zest for a living. He was as mischievous as any prep school boy. I think everyone liked Jack. He was just naturally the sort of a fellow that made friends. Not consciously, but naturally. He was that way because he couldn't be any other way. The man voted most likely to succeed was John F. Kennedy. And that is one prediction of that sort that did come true.
John Kennedy graduated from Choate when he was 18. He was tall, thin, wiry, energetic, and good-looking. But his life was to be dogged by illness. Eager to go abroad before entering college, he went to the London School of Economics, but became ill with jaundice. By this time, he had decided to break with family tradition and go to Princeton rather than Harvard, which he did. However, he had a recurrence of jaundice in December and left Princeton. In the autumn of 1936, he entered Harvard and went out for freshman football, but was too small to make the team, and suffered a back injury that was to plague him seriously later on. One of his Harvard classmates was Baird S. Clark, who is now canon of the Washington Cathedral.
I remember he went out for swimming and house sports, nothing very flamboyant or out in the open too much. He was pretty retiring. We all were aware that he had a sense of comprehension. He could grasp a whole field of knowledge and then be very firm about it. And this was a noticeable quality about the end of junior year and then very much he was a leader. He became a marshal, of course, and was on our permanent class committee. This quality was recognized in him, and he was elected by our class to this kind of an office, which is something in a class that large.
Another friend at Harvard recalls that John damaged his health further by sneaking out of the college infirmary, where he was confined with grip and high fever, to practice nightly so that he could compete for a place on the swimming team in a meet with Yale. He was on a light diet at the infirmary because of his fever, and this worried him. He was afraid he wouldn't be strong enough to win the swimming trials. So he made his friends smuggle malted milks and steaks into the infirmary. Then he would disappear from his room, rush to the indoor athletic building pool, swim several laps, and rush back to the infirmary so he would be in bed before the nurse came around to take his temperature and give him his medicine. Unfortunately, John didn't get into that Yale meet. He was beaten in the competition by Richard Trigaskis, who later became a famed war correspondent and author of the best-selling Guadalcanal Diary. John Kennedy was ill for the rest of that college year. Out of his interest in foreign affairs, he got permission from Harvard to spend the second semester of his junior year in Europe for travel and study. It had an almost immediate effect, for his final year at Harvard was by far the best of his educational career. He was determined to graduate with honors and took extra work toward that end. But his principal achievement was the writing of a thesis entitled Appeasement at Munich. Harvard professor Bruce Hopper, who tutored young John, spoke of that period.
He took my course on Russia and Asia. And then that autumn, namely 38, he took my course on Europe and international government. And if you remember, that was the time of Munich. I had been in Moscow and then stopped off in Prague and was burning hot on the subject. After that course, beginning with Munich, I was again privileged, you might say, to break new ice, so I thought, a new trail, to get a fellow off in his, for a half year in his junior year, if the cause were sufficiently great. And in this instance, his father was already ambassador in London, and it seemed a good opportunity to start or to make a precedent. And to my amazement, the request went through without much trouble, although it was not repeated. And so I loaded him up with books on political theory and got him to agree to take a course or two in the University of London, which he did. And he spent then up until August or so in Europe and traveled a great deal. But more important than anything, he followed out his theme from this earlier course with me about Munich by consulting people who had made policy and talking with British people and then talking people in Europe and so on. So he had a fairly ripened judgment, and through access to documents that seldom come to a junior or a senior in university, he came home, what you might say, loaded for bear. He would come once or twice a week, depending on the urgency, and we would thrash out the organization. The ideas were all his, the judgment was his. I was merely the, you might say, the technician challenging him. Now, why do you say that? Well, why don't you say it this way? Well, I think he preferred that way. I said, well, now, this is better usage. Or, if you like, then you have to add this clause. And so we fought it out page by page. It's his first big job in life, really. So he says, well, it was a pleasure to work with Jack because he had the material ready. And also, he was always very diligent, industrious, you might say, and punctual. And all was smiling.
In June 1940, John Kennedy graduated with honors in political science. His thesis, which had won a magna cum laude, was later revised by him and published as a book entitled While England Slept. His one interest the following year was to get into the armed forces. Because of his spinal injury, he was turned down by the Army and the Navy. But with characteristic willfulness, he undertook a rigorous course of conditioning and exercises and managed to pass a Navy physical in September 1941. After being assigned to a desk in Navy intelligence in Washington, which he found to be suffocating, he pulled strings and got a transfer to the torpedo boat training station at Millville, Rhode Island. We quote one of John's comrades in the PT boat service who told how he met John at Millville.
The first thing I did when I landed at Millville was to dig up a football and round up a bunch of the new guys who came there with me for a game of touch. We started to play, and this skinny kid in a Harvard football sweater came walking down to the field and watched us. He asked if he could get into the game. I said sure if he got another guy for the other team, which he did in a few minutes. Well, he wasn't in the game 5 minutes before he started arguing with me about the rules. I wanted to brain him. I figured he was one of the officer's kids. Well, the next day, we started classes on how to operate the boats. And it turns out that this same skinny kid is our instructor.
Well, the skinny kid asked for combat duty in the Pacific and went to a squadron based on the island of Rendova Strait, south of New Georgia, where he was made the skipper of PT-109. On the night of August 2nd, 1943, PT-109 was on patrol in the Solomon Islands when suddenly a Japanese destroyer rammed the boat squarely, cutting it in two. Two members of the crew were killed outright. The remainder reached a small island and waited and watched for rescue for the following 5 days. The morning of the sixth day, they received word that they would be picked up. And within a matter of hours, they had been rounded up and were back at their base, the worse for wear and tear, but happily alive. Another man still happily alive is a shipmate of the late president. That shipmate is George Barney Ross. This evening, Mr. Ross was interviewed by NBC's Robert McCormick in Washington. This is how it went.
Mr. Ross, considering the circumstances under which you first knew Mr. Kennedy, I think it's safe to say you must have known him about as well as anyone, because when you serve with a man under battle conditions, under fire, you certainly got to know everything there is to know about him. What sort of a person was he, in your estimation?
Well, he was a person that was able to... he was fun to be with. He was tremendous. The same sense of humor he's displayed as president was very much on the scene in those days, plus the fact he didn't have as much responsibility and was... He was a man that kept you on your toes, but he was exciting to be with and was fun to be with. We all liked him and wanted to work for him, do a good job for him.
You thought he was something a little special.
That's right. He ran a ship that could perform as well as any in the group, but there wasn't any tension. It was very loose, and there was a lot of kidding back and forth between the guys in a boat, and but there was never, the ability to call first names, and some of the guys would call him Jack or Skipper. It was always very informal, but there was never anyone took advantage of the fact that he was a skipper. He was always able to maintain his discipline in a very friendly and loose sort of way without resorting to throwing the book at anybody or anything like that. It was particularly good for PT boats because you lived in an area in 80 feet that was 13 human beings living together and eating and sleeping together, and yet the officer had to be able to maintain his position as officer and the person giving the commands and the direction. It's really a tough chore. And you almost can't read. The book wasn't written for PT boats. It was written for destroyers or that larger type ships. But
I hadn't really thought of it.
You didn't ever lose any crew voluntarily.
Well, I hadn't really thought of it, but I should think the morale problem on a boat as tiny as those things would have been at least as bad as on a submarine, except you weren't at sea for as long periods.
That's right. You were able to, and the crews were able to mingle the different boats in the base. It would be, we'd sometimes have 15 or 20 boats and their crews, and a lot of the times we'd eat on the beach. So you didn't have the confinement of a submarine, but if you had an officer who was sort of a jerk, then there were some, you had a problem. But we weren't in that situation.
The rest of the rest of the men on the boat felt substantially as you did, I assume. Otherwise, the morale wouldn't have been as good as you say it was.
We've stayed together more or less, although we're scattered all over the country. Of course, his becoming president and had something to do with that, I probably.
He did not want to emphasize his billing as a hero for the PT episode you were involved with him in, was that characteristic of him? Was that in keeping with his...
Yeah, I think he probably would have... I think probably personally he would have just soon forgotten about the whole PT boat episode, and that's the way a lot of us felt, but I think the PT boat, it appearing in the political scene was a political... His political advisors, I'm sure, felt that here's something that some of the voters will appeal to them, the war hero business. But he was always, I don't think he ever felt that this incident was anything to brag about. I mean, we didn't exactly win, you know, and I think he was a man that liked to win. He never bragged about losing.
Well, he obviously never forgot his days on PT-109.
No, he, any of the old crew or the guys from the 59 or any of the other his old friends that he knew in the PT boats are always were always welcome in his office, and most of us never took advantage of it or never bothered him a lot, but whenever there was a reason or a necessity for it, you always got a good welcome and a sincere welcome. And I had one occasion when last year, Jack Parr brought the native up, Kivu, Benjamin Kivu, who rescued was the head native in our rescue. And he came to this country and came to Washington, and we went in to see the president. And that was really a marvelous 15 minutes, because he sat down with Kivu and chatted about all the islands, and he wanted to know what was happening over here on Olasana and all these little islands that most of us probably had forgotten the names of. And Kivu, by coincidence, lived, I drew this little map for you, he lived right within 5 miles, he still lives within 5 miles of where we were stranded. And so this was a really remarkable conversation. And then as we left, by coincidence, Prime Minister Menzies was out in the hall. He was the next man to see the president. And by accident of about 3 miles of geography, Kivu would be a subject or a citizen of Prime Minister Menzies. However, the Central Solomons, where Kivu comes from, is British Crown. And Bougainville is Australian mandate. So, but he knew who Menzies was. And
well, of course, that's one reason his administration was so exciting and so interesting, that tremendous breadth of interest.
Yeah.
He was just interested in everything.
Yeah.
And from what you say, that memory that always forever impressed reporters who dealt with him, he had even about things like the war. I don't think I could begin to remember the names of any of the little islands out there. I sometimes think that we deliberately try to forget because they weren't very pleasant days.
That's right.
But he remembered all of them.
Yeah, well, he enough so that it made it, you know, the Kivu and he were able to become quite intrigued with one another. And he wanted to know, they were glad to see the Americans go. And Kivu said, oh, no, he said, send them back. But he said, don't send the war, you know, just send the Americans back. And
that's fascinating.
So,
when did you last see him?
The last time I saw him was in August. I just missed seeing him at the judicial reception. My wife and I were invited to that, and she'll be always angry at me because I was late and we didn't see him at the reception. But I did see him in his office. It was two days before the march. I guess that was that in August, or the march on Washington?
Yes, August 28th.
I remember I worked with the juvenile delinquency group, and some of us had some of the buttons on, you know, for the march. This is typical of his sense of humor. He said, Barney, he says, are you for civil rights? you know, this terrific humor. And I said, yeah, they're going to have a march here in Washington. He said, yeah. He said, I heard about it.
Well, did he actively participate in your little organization? You said that you sort of felt as though he were responsible for giving you the idea that you had something you should perpetuate in your friendship.
Well, it isn't really an organization, and probably another group that's responsible would be the press, I suppose, in keeping us together. Well, we were all together for the inauguration, which was his idea, to have the crew there and the PT boat and the parade, and we were royally entertained, and except for the snowstorm, we would have all gotten to see him.
Are any members of the crew coming in for the...
The only one I know about is John McGuire from Jacksonville, Florida. And I talked to Bill Johnson in New Hampshire, and he doesn't think he'd be able to come to the funeral, but he wanted to know what we were going to do about flowers and so forth. And I said, well, the family had indicated they want us to give some money to charity. So Bill's going to do that. Bill was very sick and recently, and so we talked about that and so forth, and he sounds fine now. So.
Well, I suppose you share probably a little bit more intensely even than most of the rest of us the feeling that, as the old German song goes, I had a comrade and she lost a friend.
Yeah. It's a very empty feeling. A lot of people have come to me and said, I know how you must feel, and it seems like all of us feel, everyone feels terribly, but I just felt like just empty, just... completely empty and mad. I wanted to strike back at somebody, and I didn't know who to strike back at, and I didn't have much to do over the weekend, unlike you fellows, but I was able to... I called my boss, Dave Hackett, who works for the Attorney General. I do, too, underneath Dave, and Dave's been out taking care of, or helping take care of the Attorney General's kids, So I've been helping Dave out a little bit with that. And kept a little bit busy, but it's just a terrible feeling.
In August 1943, an official report stated that Lieutenant Junior Grade John F. Kennedy, aged 26, had been killed in action. This report was subsequently invalidated. In November 1963... the official report came that President John F. Kennedy, aged 46, had been killed by an assassin's bullet in Dallas, Texas. This report, to an unbelieving and shocked world, was valid. Between those two dates, John Fitzgerald Kennedy fulfilled the purpose for which he had been spared.
The highest price. The life and times of John F. Kennedy will continue in 10 seconds after station identification.
WWJ and WWJ-FM, Detroit.
According to a Boston legend, John Kennedy's decision to enter politics was made shortly after the tragic death of Joseph P. Kennedy, Jr., his brother. Supposedly, the decision was the result of a dramatic scene in which John's father, Ambassador Joseph P. Kennedy, pointed out that since John now was the eldest son, he must carry on the family tradition of public service. In 1957, Ambassador Kennedy was quoted as saying, "I got Jack into politics. I was the one. I told him Joe was dead and that it was therefore his responsibility to run for Congress. He didn't want to do it, but I told him he had to do it." The year was 1945. 28-year-old John Kennedy was one of 10 candidates for Congress in Boston's 11th district. He was laughed off as a poor little rich kid. He won the election by an impressive margin. And in January of 1947, John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts took the oath of office as a United States representative on the same day and at the same hour as a young California congressman named Richard M. Nixon. John Kennedy won re-election twice and spent a total of 6 years in the House of Representatives. Nearing the end of his third term as a congressman, he realized he was now ready for a more important political post. On December 2nd, 1951, Congressman Kennedy was the guest on NBC's Meet the Press program and was asked a direct question about his political future by reporter Lawrence Spivak.
Now, Mr. Kennedy, when I was in Boston last week, I heard a good deal of talk about you. There are many who thought that you would be the Democratic nominee for the senatorship against Henry Cabot Lodge. Are you going to run?
Well, I'd like to go to the Senate. I'm definitely interested in it. I think most of those of us in the House who came in after the war, some of them have already gone to the Senate, like George Smathers and Nixon and others, and I'm definitely interested in going to the Senate. And I'm seriously considering running. I'm not sure yet what exactly I'm going to do. It's still a year away, but I'm definitely interested in it, and I'm, as I say, seriously considering running, and I should really come to a final decision after the first of the year.
He made the decision, a decision which startled many of his friends. He would try for the Senate seat of Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. It was a kind of David and Goliath match. Kennedy was a household name in Boston, but Lodge was a potent political name throughout the state. Both had remarkable similarities. They each came from famous, wealthy, and politically powerful families. They both were Harvard graduates, had splendid war records. Even their voting records on issues were similar. The campaign was mild, gentlemanly, and marked by a succession of campaign tea parties, staged by the charming and attractive women of the Kennedy clan. The result, a thunderous victory for Kennedy, made all the more impressive by its contrast to Republican landslide victories in Massachusetts that year in both the gubernatorial and the presidential races. Senator-elect Kennedy analyzed his victory when he was the guest on Meet the Press on November 9, 1952. Reporter Murray Davis of the New York World Telegram and Sun asked the question.
Senator, what do you think was the most important factor in your successful campaign over Senator Lodge?
Well, Mr. Davis, I think all these campaigns, successes and failures, are due to a number of circumstances.
Well, what
I think
do you
that's
think
true in Massachusetts.
Important?
I would say in Massachusetts, the most important one was the state itself and what's happened to it in the last 6 years and its competition with the South
and the
loss of industry. And I think that my campaign slogan was that I'll do more for Massachusetts. And I think that the feeling of the people of the state was that our interests had been neglected.
Well, there must have been something else, Senator, because your Democratic governor lost by 18,000, the Republican candidate for president won by 206,000, and you won by 68,000. There's quite a wide discrepancy there in pluralities.
That's right, but what
did you have?
I would say that that was the major factor, if there was a major factor, but there were others. I worked a lot longer and a lot harder in Massachusetts than did Senator Lodge. He was working for General Eisenhower, and I think he felt that that would take care of his Massachusetts position, particularly when General Eisenhower was successful. In addition, I think that Massachusetts has a Democratic tendency, basically. It's been Democratic through the last five presidential elections, though it didn't go this time. In addition, I think there was a desire for a change which affected all incumbents, Republicans and Democrats.
On that same program, he made an accurate prediction about the political picture 4 years hence. Lawrence Spivak's question prompted the prediction.
Now, this is pretty early to begin talking about 1956, but do you have a candidate for the presidency for 1956?
I think that it is early, and no one knows what's going to happen in the next 4 years.
Well,
I believe that Governor today, I would certainly say that Governor Stevenson would be my candidate for the presidency. I think he ran a fine campaign. He's easily the leader of the party, and I have no doubt that he's going to stay that way. It's still early to say what's going to happen in 56, but he's in the, I would say, the dominant position.
But politics was not the only matter which occupied the new senator from Massachusetts. A bachelor and Washington's best-looking young senator, Jack Kennedy resumed his courtship of Washington's prettiest inquiring photographer. She was Jacqueline Bouvier, educated at Vassar, the Sorbonne in Paris, and at George Washington University. Senator Kennedy had met her in 1951 at a dinner party. He recalled the meeting in these words. I leaned across the asparagus and asked her for a date. 2 years later, September 12, 1953, they were married in St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church in Newport. It was the most impressive wedding the old society stronghold had seen in 30 years. Some 600 diplomats, senators, and society figures witnessed the ceremony and nuptial mass celebrated by Archbishop Richard J. Cushing of Boston. More than 1,200 guests attended the reception at the 300-acre estate of the bride's mother and stepfather, Hammersmith Farm, overlooking Narragansett Bay. A crowd of 3,000 persons had cheered the newlyweds as they left the church. The senator and his bride honeymooned in Acapulco, Mexico. 1954 should have been the happiest year of Senator Kennedy's life, but it was perhaps the unhappiest. A back injury incurred in the war put him almost continually on crutches, while the pain he endured was almost unbearable. This, coupled with the possibility of malarial attacks, severely tested his health. His political well-being was under equal stress. Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin had made serious charges against the Democratic Party. Senator Kennedy was questioned about the charges during the Meet the Press program of February 14, 1954. Marquis Charles of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch brought the question up.
Do you agree with President Eisenhower that Senator McCarthy, he didn't name him, but I think he meant Senator McCarthy, and Senator Jenner and others have gone too far in the charges they've brought against the Democrats?
Well, as I remember what the president said at his press conference, he stated that he wanted those in his immediate executive, the group around him, and the Republican National Committee to not go to excesses in partisanship. I don't know whether, and he also said that he had no real control over other members of his party, but he did deplore any excesses of which I believe the gentleman you mentioned were guilty during the last week.
Well, what about this charge, Senator Kennedy, that the Democrats are constantly crying depression, and that equates more or less with the Republican charge?
Well, I don't think it equates. The Republican charge, which has been made during the last week, is that the Democratic Party is the party of treason. The charge made against the Democrats are that the Democrats are crying and attempting to push the country into a depression. I don't think either one of those charges are true. I think it's natural that with the sharp increase in unemployment during the last few months, the predictions which have been made about the country's income going below up to 5 or 10% below what it was last year, which would be a serious situation for us, it's natural that the Democratic Party, and I'm sure many Republicans, are concerned about what steps the country should take to prevent a serious recession or even a depression.
But it is true that you Democrats ran for years against Hoover, didn't you? And the Hoover Depression?
Well, I understand that's true, and I think that was unfair to Mr. Hoover. On the other hand, the Democrats did have a different program to meet the Depression with, which I believe was more successful than the program of Mr. Hoover and the Republican Party. But that's far different, I think, from calling the Democratic Party the party of treason, referring to the 20 years of the Democratic Party's control as 20 years of treason, saying that we were deliberately attempting to lose the Korean War. I think that goes beyond the legitimate areas of party dispute, and I think it has a serious effect upon the country's morale, and I think it's unnecessary and untrue.
A few moments later, NBC commentator Ned Brooks asked for a prediction about the man who would be chosen in 1956 as the Democratic presidential nominee.
Senator, still on politics, you were mentioning a moment ago your satisfaction over the leadership of Mr. Stevenson.
I was talking in addition to the leadership in the Congress.
Yes, would you be willing now to say that you favor his nomination for president at the next presidential
election? No, I think it would be premature. There are other men who have been talked about in the Congress, too, who would be strong candidates, and therefore
I think
they become announced candidates, and it would be premature.
You wouldn't take him out of the picture, though?
Not a bit. I think he's the leader of the party, and I think if he runs and if he decides to run, he'd certainly be a strong candidate. I think that Senator Simonton, Kefauver,
Overcome the fact with the rank-and-file Democrats who would be represented at a nominating convention that he was a man who carried only 9 states, I believe, and lost even part of the South? Could that be overcome, in your judgment?
Yes, it could be. There are going to be some direct primaries. He would have to enter those. If he showed strength in the direct primaries, it would indicate that 1952 was not his fault. There were many other reasons for the success of the Republicans.
Well, he lost your state of Massachusetts by something like 200,000 while you were winning it. Does that indicate any... You won it by about 60,000. Does that indicate any great strength? I don't mean for you to be modest about this, about your own popularity up there, but would that indicate any great strength...
I think that it probably indicates that General Eisenhower was an extremely strong candidate. I would think, to be fair, honest with you, that Governor Stevenson would have to enter primaries in various states in the country. If he showed his strength, if he beat the other people who were suggested, it seems to me that he would prove that he was the strongest man. But I think any candidate who's going to be the nominee next time will have to do that.
Little did John Kennedy know at that moment the year 1956 would be marked by political experts as more than just the year that Adlai Stevenson won the Democratic nomination for president. It was the year that the young senator from Massachusetts made his debut as a national political figure. The date, August 17th, 1956. The place, Chicago's International Amphitheater. Governor Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut addresses the Democratic National Convention.
This convention last night nominated the outstanding Democrat and outstanding American capable of the presidency. We have the duty, therefore, to make sure that we bring to this ticket additional strength, additional help to ensure the victory that comes in this November. John Kennedy of Massachusetts. Is an outstanding American. John Kennedy of Massachusetts is a great Democrat. John Kennedy of Massachusetts is a successful campaigner and a successful candidate every time he has run for public office. John Kennedy is something new. John Kennedy is something fresh. John Kennedy brings the vigor and youth and the fresh breezes that blow through this great nation of ours. John Kennedy has a voice and a personality that will appeal to young people. John Kennedy has a personality that appeals to the independent voter. John Kennedy has a personality that will appeal to the independent voter, Democrats, and his record shows he is unusually successful in making deep incursions in Republican ranks, too. And therefore, I give you Jack Kennedy as the next vice presidential nominee and the next vice president of the United States. Thank you.
The 1956 vice presidential race burst the Democratic convention wide open. On the first ballot, Kefauver topped Kennedy 438 and one-half votes to 304. Then the race quickened. New York swung its support to Kennedy, followed by several other southern and border states. Senator Kennedy was in the bathtub when an aide burst in and shouted, "Sam Rayburn has just swung Texas to you." Now the Kennedy bandwagon really started to roll. The second ballot put Kennedy out in front of Kefauver, 618 to 551 and a half. The Massachusetts senator needed only 68 more votes to win the nomination. Kentucky swung 30 votes to him on the third ballot. Now he was only 38 votes from victory. So near and yet so far away. Missouri swung its support to Kefauver. Other states followed, and in a few moments it was all over. Kefauver had been chosen. Senator Kennedy was calm in defeat. Convention Chairman Sam Rayburn recognized him as he approached the speaker's platform to offer the inevitable motion, the motion that is a time-honored political tradition.
Will the convention be in order? If there is no objection, the chair will recognize Senator John Kennedy of Massachusetts.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to take this opportunity first to express my appreciation to Democrats from all parts of the country, north and south, east and west, who have been so generous and kind to me this afternoon. I think that it proves, as nothing else could prove, what a strong and united party the Democratic Party is. Secondly, I think what has happened today bears out the good judgment of Governor Stevenson in deciding that this issue should be taken to the floor of the convention. Because I believe that the Democratic Party will go from this convention far stronger for what we have done here today. And therefore, ladies and gentlemen, recognizing that this convention has selected a man who has campaigned in all parts of the country, who has worked untiringly for the party, who will serve as an admirable running mate to Governor Stevenson, I hope that this convention will make Estes Kefauver's nomination unanimous. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move that we suspend the rules and make the nomination of Estes Kefauver by acclamation.
In favor of the motion will vote aye. No, no. The ayes have it. And now it is my pleasure to present the next Vice President of the United States for a moment.
This moment, despite the fact that he had missed victory by the narrowest of margins, was one of the great moments of Senator Kennedy's career. Millions who watched that moment occur on television and heard about it on radio would remember this young senator who had done his best and who had the dignity to accept defeat with a smile. And as biographer James McGregor Burns later wrote, in this moment of triumphant defeat, his campaign for the presidency was born. A defeat in 1956. But rather than fall back in discouragement, Mr. Kennedy rallied his friends and his family around him and began almost at once to plan for victory in 1960. And in a news conference on January 2, 1960, he revealed his ambition to achieve an office even higher than the one he had sought 4 years before.
I will not be a candidate. I will not be the nominee. I will not... Therefore, accept a nomination for vice president under any conditions, and as I've stated, this will not be subject to change by any conditions.
Why is that?
Because I'm a candidate for the presidency, and if I fail to achieve nomination, then I shall return to the Senate.
Senator Kennedy did return to the Senate, but only to fill out the remainder of his term. Now that he had thrown his hat into the ring, a phrase which becomes more figurative than ever, when applied to the candidate who spurned headgear even in the foulest weather, now that he had declared for the presidency, the real work began. Assisted by his carefully chosen, highly efficient campaign crew, he set out on the torturous journey that was to culminate at the convention in July. He not only had to defeat such a strong challenger as Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota in the primary elections, but he would have to overcome the even greater challenge presented by his religion. John F. Kennedy was a Roman Catholic, and no Catholic had ever been elected president of the United States. The first primary battle in Wisconsin went to Kennedy, but was considered far from a decisive victory. The religious issue had yet to be clarified as a factor in the campaign. It was in the second primary contest between Kennedy and Humphrey that the beginnings of a resolution of this question appeared. West Virginia has a population which is almost entirely Protestant, and Mr. Kennedy faced the issues squarely. In his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Making of the President, Theodore White told of what he considered to be the finest TV broadcast he ever heard a political candidate make. According to Mr. White, no transcript or recording of this speech is known to exist. But he recalled that in it, Mr. Kennedy reviewed the historical background of the separation of church and state, and that it included these words.
So when any man stands on the steps of the Capitol and takes the oath of office of president, he is swearing to support the separation of church and state. He puts one hand on the Bible and raises the other hand to God as he takes the oath. And if he breaks his oath, he is not only committing a crime against the Constitution, for which the Congress can impeach him and should impeach him, but he is committing a sin against God. A sin against God, for he has sworn on the Bible.
2 days later, West Virginia gave Mr. Kennedy the clear-cut triumph he had been seeking, and Hubert Humphrey was out of the running. In the months that followed, John Kennedy continued to campaign with unflagging vigor. And finally, at the convention hall in Los Angeles, on the night of July 13th and the early morning of July 14th, he swept aside the remaining candidates in a first ballot victory which followed the casting of this vote.
Wyoming!
Mr. Chairman, Wyoming's vote will make a majority for Senator Kennedy. We have 15 votes. There are 15 votes in Wyoming for Kennedy.
To make a total of 763, all that was needed. Although the final total went up to 806. A short time later, the triumphant candidate made a brief appearance at Convention Hall.
Governor Collins, Chairman Butler, Governor Brown, and my mother and my sister, under the official procedures of this convention, it is not possible for me to give you an answer to your nomination until Friday night. But I think you can guess what the answer will be.
There was a formal acceptance speech, of course, but before that, a vice presidential candidate was selected. And Mr. Kennedy's choice was the then Senator Lyndon B. Johnson. The first major stage of John F. Kennedy's progress to the presidency was now accomplished. Now began the incredibly demanding ordeal of the final drive, the campaign against Richard Nixon. Day and night, by train and plane, by automobile and on foot, John Kennedy moved back and forth across the nation, calling for the support of his fellow Americans in a drive to new frontiers. Once again, the specter of the religious issue, which he had thought was resolved in the West Virginia primary, raised a threatening head. And once again, he faced it openly and eloquently. We have no recording of the speech he made before the Greater Houston Ministerial Association in Texas on September 12th of 1960, but these are some of the words it contained.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be a Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. That is the kind of America in which I believe. And it represents the kind of presidency in which I believe. A great office that must be neither humbled by making it the instrument of any religious group, nor tarnished by arbitrarily withholding its occupancy from the members of any religious group. I believe in a president whose views on religion are his own private affairs, neither imposed upon him by the nation or imposed upon him as a condition to holding that office.